cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The U.S. economy is starting to show some signs of strain under the weight of decades-high inflation and climbing interest rates, raising the risk of a downturn. Bloomberg News economics reporter Rich Miller writes about this today. Rich, joining us from our Washington, D.C. bureau. Rich, good to have you with us. What we see what's happening with the financial markets, but if you look beyond those, where are you starting to see weakness in the economy?
Yeah, but I want to just make sure that we understand that, you know, that the economy still has some, you know, strong points, but there are like cracks showing in that sort of strong facade. Consumers are starting to take on more debt. I mean, they're faced with, you know, decades high inflation, having to shell out more money for food, gasoline. So consumers are taking on more debt. So that's a sign that there are some strain. The small businesses are also turning gloomier. Last month, according to ADP, the accounting firm, small businesses actually saw their payroll shrink. That was partly because they don't feel they can keep on raising wages and therefore having trouble getting workers. And then lastly, the housing market, which is kind of on the front line of the Fed's efforts to slow the economy. We've seen mortgage rates go up at their fastest pace for quite some time, and some signs of slowing down in the sort of frenetic housing market that we've had.
And Rich, I mean, from the Fed's perspective, would they be viewing these as cracks in the economy or merely just signs that maybe the economy is starting to cool?
They're probably the latter. They're probably sort of welcoming some signs that things are cooling down, and that's what they want to do. But, you know, it's what is it? The three little bears, right? Not two.
Yeah, Goldilocks.
Goldilocks. Yeah, right? You can't. You know, it's a fine line, right? You know, it's the same could be said of what we've seen in the stock market. They made very clear that they wanted to get financial conditions tighter, and that meant they wanted, you know, tacitly they were saying we wanted to see stock prices lower, and they've certainly gotten that. And but they don't want to, you know, they don't want to see them go so low that people get really discouraged and, you know, stop buying and we get thrown into recession. So it's, you know, they're walking a very, very fine line here.
So what do you need to see to prove to you that the Fed can pull this off, that the economy will be you know, in the words of Goldilocks, just right, or in the words of Jay Powell, perhaps a softish landing.
Softish landing, right, right.
Yeah.
Or some people say a semi-hard landing. But anyway, I guess the key is going to be inflation, I think. The Fed is still sort of hoping, praying that, you know, a good portion of the inflation we're seeing is due to the so-called supply side. And, you know, if inflation starts to show signs of easing, then they won't have to raise rates quite as high as they might have to, and that would increase the chances they'll pull off what, as you say, the softish landing. They've already almost sort of given up on a soft landing where, you know, everything is perfect and, you know, inflation comes down, but unemployment doesn't go up. It seems now the softish landing means, well, we're going to get a little bit of pain in the economy and probably in the jobs market, but we won't get a recession.
Well, let's dig in on that, because, I mean, the consensus coming into this year among economists was that we were going to see a slowdown, a cool down, mm-hmm. not necessarily a contraction. What is the balance of views right now when you look across the landscape? What are economists saying about the possibility now of a recession in the coming years?
I think the clear consensus is that we're going to avoid a recession. But when you ask people about what are the risks around your so-called baseline forecast, the risks that we're going to have a recession are rising. A survey that Bloomberg did within the last couple of weeks of, you know, a broad range of economists, I want to say about more than 50 economists, showed that, you know, they expected a 30% chance of a recession within the next year. But that was up from, like, 15% of those, 30, that was up from 15%, say, at the beginning of the year. So the consensus is still we're going to avoid a recession, but the trends are not in the right direction. The number of people, the risks that people assign to the possibility of recession are rising, and actually growth forecasts are coming down. Bank of America today cut its growth forecast for the fourth quarter of next year to under 0.5%, which is precariously close to zero or negative.
So, Rich, just in the last 30 seconds that we have with you, very briefly, it's interesting because it's like we think about this from the perspective of Fed officials, and we think about it from the perspective mm-hmm. of people. But what happens when people pull back because they're concerned about spending? Like, it becomes self-fulfilling in just 15 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, confidence is a key thing here. And if confidence breaks, then the economy will probably go into recession.
It's just like you talked about yesterday, Katie, with the self-fulfilling prophecy.
Speaking
right?
it into existence.
Yeah. Rich Miller, this is a great piece. Check it out on the Bloomberg Terminal. Rich is economics reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us from our D.C. bureau. Rich, thanks so much. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week on Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
While the Port of Long Beach moved 9.38 million containers in 2021, that set a record. Then came a record January, then came a record February, then came a record March, and then came a record April. What's the rest of the year look like, especially as China lifts lockdowns? Well, Mario Cordero is the executive director at the Port of Long Beach. He joins us on the phone from Long Beach, California. Mario, how are you?
How are you? Thank you. Thank you for the kind invitation.
Yeah, it's really good to have you with us. So what is May looking like, and are we going to be seeing year-over-year records every month this year?
Well, we're certainly seeing an uptick in terms of the cargo growth here at the Port of Long Beach, as you've referenced. We've had a record April, and for that matter, for the first 4 months, record numbers. As to what the rest of the year looks like, I think in the next couple months, we're going to continue with an uptick, given that we're entering a peak season, which ordinarily starts around July. And by that, I mean the cargo that comes in preparation for the fall holiday season. And then as to the last quarter of the year, I think that remains to be seen. But definitely because of the lockdown and slowdown that we've seen in China, that is the zero COVID policy that they've implemented there, I think we're going to have a domino effect once China ramps up, and you're going to see that cargo coming again in some kind of a surge.
Well, let's talk about that domino effect. You know, how is the port of Long Beach going to try to prevent the congestion that we saw in 2020 and 2021 as we enter this peak season?
Well, the good news is, as a result of the engagement of the White House, more specifically the White House envoy, we've had for several months weekly calls, two, three times a week, to address the various congestion issues. So I can represent to you that there's a full court press to address some of the issues that were at the more serious level in the fall of 2021. And one very positive metric, in January of this year, we had 109 vessels off the coast. Mm. That number now is around 32. So I think while we're still going to have some challenges, as you have probably know, every major gateway in the United States has the same challenges given the import surge here and the issues involving the disruption of the global supply chain. However, I believe we're going to be in a better position to address some of the issues that really surfaced at a very high level a year ago.
Mario, what about when it comes to labor? Because last week saw the start of crucial labor talks between the dock worker union and employers, but with both parties saying that they expect cargo to keep moving until an agreement is reached. Just give us an indication of how these talks are going.
Well, as you may know, I'm not privy to the talks. I'm not in the room. However, in my view, given the engagement with the parties throughout this process of stakeholder engagement prior to the negotiations, I'm optimistic that the parties will reach their differences or resolve their differences in a reasonable period of time. I mean, the fact of the matter is that here at this port complex, the largest in the nation, that is between Port of Long Beach and Port of Los Angeles, we moved an excess of 20 million containers in 2021. So in large part, it's because of the productivity that labor has had. So I don't expect any slowdown with regard to that productivity on the part of labor.
Well, can you talk about what contingencies you have in place to prevent that slowdown? I mean, should an agreement not be reached?
Well, I think the good news is what we've been able to do during this crisis. As one example, extended gate hours, to keep the fluidity of the cargo moving. You know, some of these terminals have weekend hours. Our terminal, TTI, we have a 24/7 pilot project, and, of course, the same on the Port of Los Angeles. So I think we have implemented measures to, again, make sure that we keep some fluidity in the movement of cargo. And with that, we've also identified land in terms of the acreage where this cargo is being moved off the terminal. So, again, I don't expect a slowdown by labor. And I think for us, we are certainly better prepared to address any type of scenario than maybe we were a year ago. So I think that's the good news in terms of what we're seeing addressing all the issues relevant to the movement of cargo here.
Hey, Mario, we've talked to CEOs at some companies over the last few months, and they've told us that one of the ways they've dealt with port congestion at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach is to actually go and use other ports north of you, and then also completely other ports on the other side of the country. What are you doing to avoid losing market share?
Well, I think this has been an ongoing dynamic for several years, that is the loss of incremental market share here at the West Coast, more specifically the nation's largest port complex. Now, other gateways, be it New York, New Jersey, Savannah, Charleston, Houston, they've all done a great job in uplifting their respective infrastructure. So certainly we are very cognizant that shippers have a choice. On the other hand, I think that this gateway here is the gateway most approximate, the most important trade region to this country, to the USA, which is Asia. And at the end of the day, we could move that container to Chicago, to the Midwest, faster than any direct service to the Gulf or to the East. That dynamic will continue. I think our partnership with the railroads and the substantive discussions we're having with them to make sure we keep competitive will again, in my opinion, we will remain competitive. Now, again,
right.
I want to say one thing, that if you look at these other gateways, I mean, just in the news this week.
Just very briefly, 10 seconds.
Go ahead. In the news this week, the congestion is happening in New York and New Jersey. So this is a dynamic
right.
that every major gateway is addressing.
Mario Cordero, Executive Director at the Port of Long Beach.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, according to the World Health Organization, the coronavirus pandemic has directly and indirectly killed nearly 15 million people around the world. So how do we prevent the next pandemic? It's the question of a new book by Brian Bremner, global business executive editor here at Bloomberg News. He argues that it hinges on better understanding the billions of tiny pathogens circulating in nature. Brian Bremner is global business executive editor. He joins us on the phone from London. Joel Weber is the editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us on the Access line from Brooklyn. This story is featured in the new issue of Business Week magazine. It's available on newsstands, on the Bloomberg terminal, and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. So, Joel, why are these teeny tiny invisible things so crucial to understand?
Yeah, they're not invisible. You just got to go super, super small.
Oh, invisible to me and to the naked eye, right?
There you go. Right.
Okay.
So the microbe is sort of the thing that Brian went long on here. And in addition to this remarks in the magazine, it's subject of his book, Man versus Microbe. If you're a close watcher of Business Week, you may remember those words because in the very, very, very early days of the pandemic, right as we started to appreciate how big of a story this was going to be, Brian and I talked, and he spooled up what became a very early cover story for us with a similar line, man versus microbe. And as the pandemic went along, and Brian helped oversee so much of Bloomberg News's amazing coverage, he got an urge to pursue it as a book. And what I find fascinating about this is really how future-orientated this idea is. We're talking about virus, obviously, when we talk about COVID. A virus is one of many different microbes. They are out there. And our understanding of microbes is so limited. And that's kind of where Brian's reporting goes. And I'll turn it over to him. Brian, we are making progress scientifically on this front, almost it feels now like probably daily, right? But where could things go?
Well, it's a really interesting time because we're kind of in the third year of the pandemic. But the COVID pandemic is coincided with kind of a big transformation in biology. It's, you know, we're now applying technologies like AI, big data analytics, automation, and CRISPR gene editing technology. So we're now at a point where we can redesign the source code for microbes and a lot of biological systems. And the reason that's important in the context of how do we get better at pandemic management is that this crisis has taught us that if you let any kind of pathogen scale up into population centers, it's really game over. And this pandemic, our battle with the virus really kind of ended in March of 2020 when the hotspots around the world, you know, took off. And the reason is that when you get to a certain scale, we tend to, you know, experience social disorder and we're on our back legs and we have to kind of make very, very tough choices between saving lives and letting our economies collapse. And we don't want to be in that position. So I think the answer, if you talk to people who are devoting their careers to this, is that we've got to take this battle to the molecular level. And that means building a biosurveillance system that allows us to kind of track these pathogens really early when they're kind of circulating around nature and in animal communities, and then try to disrupt them or at least manage the outbreaks much earlier in the process before you kind of have that societal impact.
Well, Brian, the challenge there is you write in this excerpt of your new book, Man versus Microbe, What Will It Take to Win, is that as humans, we're not really wired to react to risks that we can't see or feel in the here and now. So how do we change that wiring?
Well, it's difficult because, as you know, you're right. I mean, we're just, you know, the way we evolved was just to see a clear and present danger threats, you know, the snake slithering through the grass or the, you know, the car that jumps the median in oncoming traffic and things like that. Biological events are slow moving, they're infrequent, and what's happened, if you look at the history of infectious disease outbreaks, is that we get caught in this pattern of, you know, panicking, freaking out, responding, rushing, you know, healthcare responses, and then when the crisis, you know, passes, we kind of move back into this position of studied inaction. And the reason we can't do that any longer is that the cadence of these infectious disease outbreaks this century have been increasing. And the reasons are multi, you know, faceted. I mean, one big one is that humanity is just kind of encroaching on natural habitats as we, you know, our megacities take off and our food industry, which is livestock intensive, keeps, you know, expanding. So again, we need to use our best technologies and build a surveillance system, you know, at the microbe level. We kind of have to take the contest to them rather than letting them kind of run wild in our population centers, and then we end up with these terrible situations we're in.
You know, Brian, I'm curious. Some buzzwords have cameos in the excerpt, but I'm really genuinely curious about how AI factors into this, because what you're talking about here, the data sets are obviously enormous. And how is AI playing out in terms of how we could potentially meet the challenge that the microbes present?
Yeah, when you talk to people in the worlds of biology and computer science, they're very excited about the possible applications of AI and drug discovery. You know, just like mathematics was a very powerful descriptive language for physics last century, a lot of people think AI is going to help us decode the complexity of biology. And why is that? Well, so much of biology is becoming digital. You know, we're now building these pretty big biobanks. When people, you know, genetically sequence a microbe or a cell or a complex of cells, that all gets stored away in databases that AI programs can kind of rifle through. And, you know, one of the most dramatic examples of that happened a few years ago at MIT, where synthetic biologist James Collins and his team used an AI program to rifle through like 100 million chemical compounds, gave them some instructions about what kind of antibiotic they might, you know, be interested in, and the program found it. And they found a structurally unique antibiotic that they nicknamed Halcyon after the creepy computer from 2001 Space Odyssey.
Brian, we're going to have to leave it there. Just very quickly, 5 seconds, optimistic or pessimistic after writing this book?
I'm optimistic.
Okay.
I think
optimistic.
Long-term, we're going to...
There it is. Brian Bremmer, Global Business Executive Editor. His new book out, Man versus Microbe, What Will It Take to Win? Also joined by Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, Bitcoin is down nearly 60% from its highs back in November. Terra USD and Luna have collapsed. We've covered that closely here over the last 2 weeks. What's it looking like when it comes to crypto, at least in venture capital? For that, we turn to Rob Frasca, managing partner at Cosmo Ventures. It's a venture capital fund. It's tokenized. It invests in early stage blockchain projects and opportunities. Rob, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
We're doing well. I mean, you know, it is a bear market, but
It is Friday.
It is Friday. So I guess there's a silver lining to everything, right?
That's right, and we're going to be warm this weekend.
Mm-hmm. We are. Well, you're somebody who's seen quite a few market cycles, and I'm wondering how you're viewing this specifically right now in your world, not in the world of public equities, but in the world of blockchain.
Yeah, so I'm an early .com guy. I did a bunch of companies through the whole kind of .com life cycle. Took one public, took another one, and sold it. And so when I look at what's happening here, it's very similar. You know, tech grows exponentially, and generally what winds up happening in tech is there's a lot of excitement. And that excitement of the promise of a new technology, people jump in, and then you kind of get a little bit of over exuberance, around that tech, and it tends to go a little bit beyond what its promise is at that moment. And you can't get caught up in kind of the short term volatility. If you really believe in a new technology, and you really believe in what the capabilities are and the value creation it's going to be, then you got to take a longer term focus. So I think that, we invest in blockchain. We mm-hmm. believe that blockchain is really, I actually think it's bigger than the internet itself. I think it's the single Well, when you think about the early days of the internet, right, what was it all about? It was all about kind of peer-to-peer content, right? All of a sudden, anybody could create a content and publish it. And now we've got a world where everybody's a content creator, right? And I did a company in that space. And then you think about the second phase of the internet, it was kind of the decentralization or the peer-to-peer of communication. And then kind of the third phase was the decentralization of commerce. Now anybody can sell anything to anybody. Mm. And the one thing in our world that's still kind of centralized is trust, right? We use banks, we use brokers. Our entire society is based on this kind of concept of centralized trust. It's a problem when you kind of connect those central institutions of trust to a networked world like the internet, right? They become kind of hacker targets, right? So what blockchain does is it kind of solves that problem. It decentralizes trust. And so all of a sudden, we're kind of creating this whole new peer-to-peer financial layer. Mm-hmm. And the ramifications of that are just massive. They're just absolutely massive.
Well, Rob.
And so as venture cap. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, the pitch I hear for things like Web 3.0 is that it's going to combine the blockchain and the internet, that basically you're going to put the internet
exactly.
on the blockchain. Is that your view of it as well? Are you investing along that thesis?
Absolutely along that thesis. We're all in on this. I like I said, I'm a .com guy, and I always tell my partners, I said, man, we've seen this movie before several times. We've been in this movie as entrepreneurs. And we sort of know how it ends. So I do believe that. I think that what Web3 really is the promise of the decentralization of everything. You know, the whole NFT craze, right? Everybody's talking about NFTs, and they talk about these pictures and this artwork.
JPEGs.
And all that stuff, right? You know, JPEGs. It's like digital Beanie Babies, right?
Yeah.
For me, the reason why I'm excited about NFTs is really what it's about is the decentralization of digital rights. It's kind of like royalty management. It's digital rights management. And that has profound effects on society, right? So it's not so much about the artwork itself. It's the fact that now all of a sudden I can use technology to kind of manage those royalties. So for our perspective, we're all in. We invest in this space. And it's hard not to get caught up in this kind of short-term volatility, right,
yeah.
when you see what's going on. You're like, holy cow, right? I was up at 60,000.
Yeah. Rob, we only have a minute left, so I want to make sure to get this in.
Sure, sure.
We talked earlier this week to Lizette Chapman. Her big take story here at Bloomberg was about the belt tightening that we're seeing in Silicon Valley. You're not in Silicon Valley. You're in Boston, but you do have more than 20 portfolio companies. I'm wondering what you're telling them about this decline that we're seeing right now. What are you telling them to hold off on hiring, to freeze hiring? What are you saying?
Yeah. look, ultimately, this is global. This is absolutely global. It's way beyond Silicon Valley. This is a total global phenomenon. Anytime you have a downturn in the market, you have to be prudent. You got to tell the entrepreneurs that are running these businesses, you know, cash is king. Make sure you understand that you've got runway and that you can deliver. So, you know, it would be irresponsible to not say that. However, I do believe that this is the early inning of blockchain. And so I think there's a lot of room to grow here. Only 10% of the world is really using this, which means there's 90% of the world yet to come online, which means a lot of growth is still there.
Right.
So just deal with the short-term volatility, but really you got to look at the long-term prospect of this.
Rob Frasca, managing partner, Cosimo Ventures. Rob, this afternoon, joining us on the phone from Boston. It's a tokenized venture capital fund that invests in early-stage blockchain startups. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week on Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit EY.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Yo.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep driving, you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Well, stocks getting a bid as we drive to the close. We are just about 10 minutes away from the close here. Office session lows, the S&P 500 down 0.3%, the NASDAQ composite down 0.8%. Let's get right to it with Alan Zafran, the founding partner and co-CEO at IEQ Capital. Alan joining us once again on the phone from Foster City, California. Alan, good to have you back with us. How are you?
I'm doing great, Tim. Great to be on with you and Katie today.
It's a good day to have you on because I'm curious about your take on the economy and the markets. Is the sky falling?
Temporarily it's falling. I think the challenge is we've got really bad sentiment in the market, but bad sentiment doesn't create a market bottom and even lower valuations. We're now trading at PE multiples below the 25-year average on the S&P 500 index if you believe current earnings estimates, but valuations don't create bottoms either. What creates a bottom in the market is when finally the economy bottoms or when the Fed finally decides to go from tightening to loosening, and there's no evidence yet we're at either point. So we're in this funny spot.
Yeah.
Sentiment is terrible right now. So we're ready for a bear market rally, but it's still probably a bear market rally until such time as there's evidence the economy is very close to a bottom or the Fed is ready to go from tightening to go back to a more looser policy. And that could be a while.
That could be a while, given where inflation is, Alan. So I'm wondering which one happens first, and what's the sign that you'll see that the economy has hit a bottom?
Well, if you're looking for the economy at the bottom, it's going to take a while because ultimately when you're getting towards the bottom of economic, you look at the leading indicators, and what you're going to want to see, we're far from there, is new orders improving relative to inventories being built up, or you're going to see earnings revisions going up on companies, not down, or you're going to see credit spreads narrowing, or you're going to see long-term bond yields rising because they've been falling over the last couple of weeks. And in a slowdown of the economy that we are in the midst of or about to see, it's going to take a while to see that again, or you're eventually going to see other evidence of economic activity, we have to go through this economic slowdown, which stock prices have already front run.
Right.
Stock prices have gone down. The economy hasn't really slowed down yet, and it's about to.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to hear you say that, you know, that's already priced in stocks. I mean, when you look across other asset classes, do you think that it's also priced when you look at things like treasuries, when you look at the credit markets?
You know, the reality is we're priced in, if this is your run-of-the-mill correction, on average, if you look at the set of corrections that have taken place since 1980, the average decline in the S&P is about 17%. Hmm. However, talking about a full-on recession-driven bear market, the average decline peak to valley is 33%. So the problem with going on right now is the dispersion of estimates among analysts on Wall Street about what is the earnings outlook is incredibly high. It's near an all-time record high because there's so much uncertainty as to what impact the inflation that we've seen will have on profit margins. And that's why we're getting these rampant movements up and down. It's also what makes for bear market rallies. We've already seen two significant rallies while falling 20%. And if history's any guide, we'll see several more before we get through all this volatility. And so I think what's a little different, 2 years ago, we had the most rapid decline in March of 2020, falling 33%. We also had the most rapid recovery of a bear market because you have the federal government and the Federal Reserve throwing massive amounts of money in the economy. It won't happen this time. And so much as I'd like to hope it were to happen, I think what's going to happen this time, this is a recalibration of where valuation should be, but it's going to take longer to get back up to where we were because you can't count on government and Federal Reserve stimulus to prop this economy up as quickly as it did from 2 years ago. And people like me suffer from recency memory. I remember what it was like 2 years ago and think it's going to pop right back up.
Yeah.
It's going to take a while this time.
So when should people,
you're not going to get that stimulus.
So when should people, if people have cash to deploy, when should they start deploying that cash?
Well, I think you have to begin to be a buyer. Anytime you're buying as a long-term investor, when you're 20% down on the S&P and close to 30% down on the NASDAQ, if you're taking a long-term view, I think it's outlandish not to begin to dollar-cost average into the weakness.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how bad could it get? So just to give you a sense, okay, we're trading right now at about 16.5 times current conventional estimates for 2020. Where current estimates are right now, 12 months forward. If you think the market should trade at its average multiple in the last 25 years, we're already at fair value. The problem is, if you think the earnings drop and you want to lower that multiple to where multiples trade in recessions and there's a wide dispersion, call it anywhere from, believe it or not, as low as 8 to as much as 20 times earnings, let's call it 14, 15 times lower earnings, I could make an argument you're going to get down to about 3,200, 3,300 on the S&P. That's another 15% down from here. That would get you down top to bottom 33%, which conveniently is exactly what happened in March of 2020. If you believe that to be true, that's a pretty bad case. You're really hitting earnings by about 10% from already here, which would mean inflation stays around probably as deeply as most bears would believe. I think you don't know if it's going to get that bad, and markets are ripe for rallies at any moment in time. And if you miss the rally, you know, you miss those handful of days when we finally snap back and you've missed the move. I think you have to start dollar cost averaging, but depending on how bearish you are, your dollar cost averaging slowly down either to 3,500 or 3,200 on the index. If it gets that low, there's no assurance it will.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite possible we're near a bottom here. But if you're really bearish, you start to buy here, but you nibble and you go slowly. Because if you want to make a bear case, you know, go down to 14 times reduced earnings, and you're down to like 3,200. And so if everyone wants to know how deep is this going to be and how long can it last, no one knows because nobody at this moment can understand the impact of China shutting down its economy due to COVID concerns, screwing up the supply chain and the implications for inflation, which are implications for profits.
Well, Alan, to your point
that... That level of uncertainty is the problem.
To your point that, you know, no one can really know how deep this is going to go, I have a sort of philosophical question. I mean, is there any way to distinguish at this moment a bear market rally from a true rally, or is that just impossible to know without hindsight?
I mean, it's largely the latter.
Mm-hmm.
it's largely the latter. It's usually what happens is the problem with that is you're trying to forecast future fundamentals and the speed at which they show up, and you can't really do so. So I think it's impossible to discern one from the other.
All right, Alan, we only got a minute left, but just briefly give us your ideas of where you're deploying capital right now, because I know that you see that you say that cash and traditional fixed income are the least attractive asset classes.
So, yes. So, first of all, if you're in an inflationary environment, I think still owning short-duration, income-generating, inflation-sensitive assets like REITs or even private REITs or private senior-secured floating-rate lending makes tremendous sense because they're inflation-sensitive assets that will do well in an inflationary environment. Secondly, if you're looking at stocks, avoid the high beta stocks or high the deep cyclical stocks, because if the economy is going to weaken, the weakness in the earnings are going to be more rampant in those cyclical and highly leveraged names. Look for stocks that have high operating margins, high interest rate coverages, high returns on assets, and relatively consistent revenue streams with low volatility. High quality companies at this point in the cycle.
Alan Zafran, founding partner and co-CEO at IEQ Capital. Alan joining us once again on the phone from Foster City, California.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.